You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the bulk of the nation's biggest school districts are planning to begin the fall semester online or with a mix of in-person and virtual classes. We'll find out how schools are dealing with the pandemic and how parents can tell if a virtual plan for their child is any good. First, with new travel restrictions, safety protocols, and booking policies, traveling has gotten a lot more confusing because of the coronavirus. What precautions do you have to take when flying? Is it okay to take a road trip? Are hotels open? Do I have to quarantine when I get back? What's the penalty if I cancel tickets? To sum it all up, is it safe to travel now? The Wisconsin Department of Health Services is urging people to stay put, quoting from their website, "Staying home is the best way to protect yourself and others from getting sick. We recommend Wisconsinites cancel or postpone all travel, including travel within the state." If you do decide to get away or you're trying to make plans for down the road, what do you need to know? Deborah Dunn is the travel editor of the Wall Street Journal. Debbie, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Barbara Peterson is senior correspondent for aviation at Condé Nast Traveler and a Wall Street Journal contributor. She's the author of Blue Streak, Inside JetBlue, the Upstart That Rocked an Industry. Barbara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Debbie, the two of you have been updating this ongoing Q&A piece about traveling during COVID-19 over at the Wall Street Journal. Generally speaking, I mean, are you feeling like people are making travel plans, getting out there, and wise to do so, if so?
Yeah, I think they're starting to. You know, I think everybody was cooped up for months at a time, and they're starting to kind of peek out under the rock and travel, you know, not too far from home. But we're hearing from a lot of readers who are just trying to get out there and trying to be safe about it. And like you said, it's really confusing. It's hard to kind of navigate all of the changing restrictions, for one, and not just worrying about your own health, but trying to figure out what every state is doing, what every county is doing. So, yeah, a lot of questions out there.
All right. Well, Barbara, let's start with flying. You cover the airline industry. What do we know about the safety of being in a plane with other humans?
Yes. Well, a lot of people are asking that. And clearly, a lot of people are just really, you know, erring on the side of caution and just not flying, because right now, air travel is down by 80%, which is just unthinkable in the middle of the summer. You know, it's just in one sense, that's actually makes it safer, right? There's fewer people traveling, so social distancing should be easier. But it's a little more complicated than that. I would say if people ask if it is safe to fly, the experts that I've talked to say, actually, it is safer than you'd think. And it's almost counterintuitive. There you are, you're packed into this aluminum tube with a lot of strangers. And even if you're all wearing masks, I mean, you don't really know who the other passengers are. So I think that sounds like it's got all the ingredients of a risky situation. But in fact, aircraft ventilation systems are much better than, say, in a typical office building or any other place you might go, a restaurant or in a train station. They use the equivalent of the filters that are used in hospital operating rooms. So the aircraft cabin air is not an issue. And I think, you know, as long as airlines keep people apart, and that each airline does it a little bit differently, so you really need to check when you're flying. Some of them will block the empty middle seat. So given those two factors, it shouldn't be risky. It's just, I know a lot of people just don't feel comfortable right now. Mm-hmm.
Now, how about somebody saying, okay, I think I want to try this out, but not now, but in 3-4 months, I'll get a ticket for then. What if things get worse and they want to cancel? What is the current state of the art for canceling a plane ticket?
Well, if you book right now, meaning within the next week, the airlines have a policy where they'll allow you to change a ticket without any additional charge. And they will let you rebook your flight. It depends on the airline, of course, but it could be up to the following year. So you will have leeway to change your plans, and you don't have to give them any reason for doing so. No questions asked, because the airlines understand that they're not going to get people to buy tickets unless they really emphasize that you're not going to get locked into it and lose your money.
And you can change your destination, right, Barbara?
Yes, exactly. And frankly, right now, with the airlines are really trying to get people to book, you may find some good fares if you book now for, say, following winter or even next spring or summer. So it is worth, if you really know you're going to be traveling, it might be worth it to do that.
Right. We're talking about traveling during and hopefully soon after COVID-19. We have Barbara Peterson and Deborah Dunn with us. They have an ongoing Q&A with travel safety questions at the Wall Street Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you traveling? Are you postponing it indefinitely? Do you have a question about if you're going to travel, the safest way to do it? Call in at 800-642-1234. All right, that's flying. Debbie, let's go on a road trip now. What kind of things should people keep in mind if they're going to want to hit the road within a state, interstate, whatever?
Yeah, I think they should really plan carefully. I mean, it is, you know, it is very tempting, right? Everybody's saying this is the summer of the road trip, and I think that's true. But you can't just be spontaneous like you once were. So you really should plot it out to make sure that there are restaurants open where you're going, that there are some takeout drive-through places. Maybe you want to plan your meal stops ahead of time. You want to look at the hotels and route to make sure that A, they're open, and B, they're practicing kind of responsible COVID cleaning protocols. And you want to look at the states you're driving through and what restrictions they might have in place.
Yeah,
so one good spot to do all that, yeah, that's sort of a lot, is AAA. Good old AAA has a pretty wonderful interactive trip planner map that keeps track of all of these restrictions.
What should I look for when I'm looking at a hotel? First of all, after I make sure that it's open, or hotel or other travel residence, how can I, as a consumer, feel confident that they are being safe and cleaning well and so on?
Well, one easy way is just to look at the site. I mean, a lot of them are very happy to list on the website all of the measures that they've taken. Or you call them and simply ask. And the ones who have put a lot of things in place, I mean, there are a lot of the American Lodging Hotel Association has a list of guidelines for its, I don't know, 60,000 members. And there's a, you know, it's a long list. So any hotel that's following those things will proudly tell you what they're doing. And
all
if
right,
they don't have anything to say, then try another hotel.
Now, Barbara, let's talk about international travel right now. Right now, I guess it's pretty easy. Most countries don't want Americans coming to them right now. Is that right?
Precisely. And it's really, really almost come to a dead halt. Right? You know, with the European Union, for example, just saying, you know, issuing this blanket, you know, ban on U.S. visitors, and, you know, except for essential travelers. And of course, if you're going on vacation, you're not exactly an essential traveler. So hence the number of international flights is way down as well. A lot of airlines that had announced they were going to fly, you know, this summer to Paris or Madrid or, you know, where, they've canceled the flight, so, or suspended at least, you know, until maybe, you know, later this fall. So right now there are some countries opening gradually, and I think Debbie, you've got a little more information on a couple in Europe, but I will say a number of Caribbean nations have reopened. They will, though, they're not just going to wave you through when you arrive. Say, for example, the Dominican Republic or Antigua or St. Lucia, they all will give you a COVID test when you arrive, unless you come bearing one that was very recently taken back home. Some of them require masks out in public and even at the beach. So, you know, for a lot of people, that doesn't sound like a really great recipe for a fun laid-back vacation.
Nah.
So I think that's unfortunately where it stands now. I mean, now, Debbie, I know you know some European countries that are trying to U.S. tourists.
Yeah, and again, it changes all the time, right? Because we had talked about earlier, there are a few countries we thought would open to Americans, and they've since close the borders again to Americans. So so it's really, it's a tricky subject, but I think Croatia is now open as long as you take a COVID test either beforehand or once you arrive. Belize, I think Belize has the same type of procedure in place. And Turkey, I think, is also now open to travelers, but really it changes week by week.
We're talking about how the coronavirus is changing the way we travel with Barbara Peterson and Deborah Dunn. Barbara's a senior correspondent for aviation at Condé Nast Traveler and a contributor to The Wall Street Journal. Debbie is the travel editor of The Wall Street Journal. They've got a pretty comprehensive Q&A piece about traveling during the pandemic. You can check that out at WPR.org/Central Time. We also have links with travel recommendations from Wisconsin's Department of Health Services. You can also join in at 800-642-1234. Are you traveling this summer? Plane, train, automobile? How are you doing it? Where are you going? What kind of precautions are you taking? Or have you put travel on hold, maybe even had to cancel plans, try to cancel or postpone tickets? Do you have a question for our guests who are really trying to stay on top of the safest ways to travel? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about travel during the COVID-19 pandemic. The State Department of Health Services recommends people stay home as much as they can. Most foreign countries are closed to non-essential travelers from the United States. Some will allow Americans with a quarantine or maybe a COVID test. Tomorrow, United Airlines will start requiring passengers to wear masks, even in the airport, in addition to on the plane. We're getting it sorted out now with a couple of travel writers. Deborah Dunn, travel editor at The Wall Street Journal. Barbara Peterson, senior correspondent for aviation at Condé Nast Traveler, contributor also to The Wall Street Journal. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are your summer vacation plans, if any, looking like? Have you canceled trips? Are you going ahead with something, maybe scaled down, driving instead of flying? How concerned are you about catching and spreading the coronavirus? And you have questions about flying, crossing state lines, staying at hotels, you name it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Debbie, cruises were a big concern very early in the COVID-19 outbreak. Are they at sea again? Where are we on cruise trips?
Yeah, cruises. Cruises were really hurt by this. So most cruises have canceled. Most cruise lines have canceled their cruises through mid-September. And the CDC actually and the State Department have told Americans not to cruise. The CDC issued a no-sail order, which is pretty unusual. I don't know if they've ever done that. A no-sail order, and they keep extending it. And now it's extended through September. And Princess Cruises just announced that they won't be sailing until December, mid-December. And everybody I spoke to, all the cruise experts I spoke to, think that that's probably will be the case with the other major cruise lines. They too won't sail again until at least December. Now, I was just going to say, you know, interestingly, in Europe, some of the smaller cruise lines, the European cruise lines, they're starting to sail again on a really limited basis. You know, the river ships. They're instituting limited capacity aboard, and they have all sorts of new measures in place. But I think everybody here is carefully looking to see how that goes.
And let's look at rental cars now, Barbara. What's up with car rentals? Can we rent them? And what do we know about what happens between a previous occupant of the car and us?
Yes, well, actually, car rentals are probably a lot safer than many other transportation options, specifically public transportation options. At least you've got your own space. And car rental companies, just like we were talking about earlier about the hotels, they post in great detail all of the measures that they're taking. Basically, they give the car a total deep cleaning, you know, certainly something more than you'd get in, you know, if you just took it to a car wash, between every rental. And in fact, when I rented a car recently from Enterprise, and they demanded that I stand there and watch it while, you know, they scrubbed down everything and hosed it and, you know, put disinfectant all over the place. So yes, they're certainly aware that they have to reassure customers that they're getting a pristine car. So I would say car rental companies right now are in a pretty good position, and as I understand it, they are doing pretty well, also precisely because they're offering, you know, an alternative to traveling with a lot of strangers.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Hank is with us in Prentice. Hank, hi.
How you doing? I just wanted to let you know, I recently did a motorcycle trip and took the SS Badger across from Manitowoc to Ludington and then traveled the western shore of Lake Michigan, southern shore of Lake Superior. But I was very impressed with how the SS Badger handled social distancing, how people were taking the responsibility and masking up, even all through Michigan, the campgrounds, everything. It would be really nice to see Wisconsin and the rest of the country kind of follow that lead. Maybe we can get rid of this thing.
Hank, thank you so much for sharing your experience. I appreciate that. And the SS Badger would be the ferry that goes across Lake Michigan, if you're not familiar with that, to our guests. Are you seeing, Debbie, people taking things seriously when they travel, wearing the masks, doing the social distancing, like Hank said, at least on the ferry and on the other side of Lake Michigan?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for everybody who's traveling, but I think certainly the readers who write in and, people I've been talking to are very, very conscientious. They want to get out of their house, but they don't want to be too reckless about it. So, yeah, a lot of people are bringing, packing a lot of masks, not just one, packing their own disinfecting wipes. I think taking every precaution they can.
Hank, thanks so much for calling in. We'll go to Annie now in La Crosse. Annie, hello.
Hi. Say, I have a friend whose husband has been delayed in Pakistan for the past 3 months. He finally is getting a flight out and she's picking him up in a couple of days in Chicago. Can she expect just to be able to take him home? Are there any restrictions that I should tell her about?
Interesting. Barbara, what do we know about somebody coming in from overseas? Can they just hop in a car and go home then?
Well, this has been an issue ever since, the lockdown started, and there were a lot of people who were overseas who just, first of all, had a hard time getting back home. I'm sorry to hear that it's taken so long, for him to get back. Yeah, the short answer is yes, you must assume that once you arrive in the country, you're going to get sort of debriefed by one of the officials there. You go through customs and immigration anyway. The CDC has people posted at every airport where international flights would be arriving. And you will get the guidance at that point. They don't necessarily require that you quarantine, but they may recommend it. Okay, so that's really... Again, it's the guidance that you'll get when you arrive back into the United States. Now, there's so few people flying now internationally, and the official word from the State Department is that you cannot fly from most countries into the United States without serious restrictions. So this person obviously is an essential traveler. This is essential. It's not, discretionary. So I think they would obviously, there's not going to be any trouble entering the country. But what the guidance will be, well, I would say likely they will give, they usually take your temperature. They, ask you questions to see if you're, healthy. And based on that, they may give you further guidance or advice.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Jean now in Waterloo. Jean, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Jean?
Hi. I wanted to ask about the protocols for timeshare specifically. We had previously planned 3 trips for this year. 2 were canceled on us, but this third one is coming up in August. We've called the resort. They are still open and operating, but they said they're operating at 30% capacity and are following all protocol for timeshare standards for cleaning. What does that mean?
And just briefly, Jean, where is this timeshare? Where are you headed?
Lake Buena Vista, Florida.
Florida,
so
okay.
It's in Orange County.
Debbie, thoughts on timeshare safety?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question. And I would ask them for more details. I mean, Airbnb and other vacation rental sites also have their own protocols. But I would just ask them, they should have it in writing, really. And I would compare it with what the American Hotel and Lodging Institute are doing. But, you know, I think the key things are a deep clean, right? I think and airing out the unit, you know, before guests, maybe leaving it empty for a day or two. And maybe with a timeshare, that's not as much of an issue with a hotel. But I would put the onus on them to tell you exactly what they're doing.
Thanks a lot for that call. We just have a minute left. Barbara, can you leave us with some advice for people to ponder as they consider if, when, where, and how to travel?
Yes. Well, I guess my main, you know, thought would be take charge of your safety. You know, I was even talking about the airlines and the hotels and car rentals or you name it, have all been talking about what they're doing to make things safe, you know, from disinfecting the environment to social distancing. But you have to go ahead and assume that anyone you could come in contact with could possibly be infected. And I know that's not something you want to have top of mind while you're traveling, but just bring, you know, all your own disinfectant wipes, bring tons of hand sanitizer, try to stay afraid. Of course, always wear your face covering and keep distant from other people, especially if they don't happen to have one. And just really be cognizant, be aware. But if you take all of those steps, there's no reason why you can't travel safely.
We'll leave it there for now. Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be there.
Debbie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Deborah Dunn is travel editor of the Wall Street Journal. Barbara Peterson, senior correspondent for aviation at Condé Nast Traveler. We've got a link to their ongoing Q&A piece at the Wall Street Journal and to guidance from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services when it comes to travel. You can check out both those resources at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll find out how schools around the country are getting ready for the upcoming school year amid the coronavirus and how parents can help ensure their kids get the most out of online learning. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow morning at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests take a tour of Wisconsin State Parks with a focus on accessibility for visitors with different needs. That's tomorrow at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. Madison bartender Amy Moreland has been out of work since mid-March. She immediately applied for state unemployment insurance and eventually started receiving an extra $600 per week from the federal CARES Act stimulus package. But as Bridget Bowden reports, that federal benefit is set to expire at the end of the month, leaving Moreland and many other jobless Wisconsinites unsure about what happens next.
Amy Moreland has been receiving $600 per week in unemployment benefits from the federal stimulus. She's been putting almost all of it toward rent and food. But in early July, her air conditioner broke. Looking at units on Amazon, she pondered whether or not she could afford a new one.
With my unemployment running out so soon and with no idea whether there's a job in sight, it seems like a bad idea, but it also, while I'm sweating with all the fans in my living room, it seems like a great idea.
Moreland decided not to buy the air conditioner. She's among millions of Americans who've received the extra federal money, and she considers it a lifeline. Contemplating the next few months without that help is a terrifying proposition.
I'm really scared. It doesn't look like there's an end in sight to this, or at least not for the summer. And pretty soon, I'm not going to be getting any money to live.
As Congress returns to session this week, lawmakers will debate whether to extend the benefit. In May, the Democratic-controlled U.S. House passed a $3 trillion coronavirus aid package that would extend the extra $600 payments through January 2021. Senate Republicans have said they oppose this bill. Emily Savard is a program and policy analyst for the Wisconsin Unemployment Division, which distributes the federal unemployment money. She says any changes from the federal government will take time to program into the department's 1970s-era computer system. With any decision from Congress coming so close to or past the program's expiration date, it could add more delays to an already backlogged system.
We're preparing for several different scenarios. But again, with our system, it does cause stress because our system is so old and archaic and it is hard to program. And depending what happens, again, we'll need to prioritize what needs to be programmed and how to do it.
Moreland will continue to receive regular state unemployment insurance should the extra federal funds vanish. She gets $114 per week after taxes, not nearly enough to pay her rent. But that, too, will eventually run out. She should be able to get an extension in the future, but she'll have to wait until she exhausts her regular unemployment.
And so I just keep saving all my money and putting it towards bills. And hoping that someday I'll go back to work.
More than anything, Moreland wishes to safely return to her former job. The bar where she worked reopened in June, only to close the next day as COVID-19 cases spiked in Dane County. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The story is part of Outbreak Wisconsin, an ongoing series from WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Now we're about a month away from the start of a new school year, and many questions remain about how districts plan to manage the coronavirus. According to Education Week, 9 of the nation's 15 biggest school systems will hold all of their classes online to start the year. Of the other 6, 2 are doing a combo of online and in-person, 2 are going entirely in-person, and the other 2, undecided. In Wisconsin, the decision is being left to individual school districts. Some are opening their doors at least partially. Earlier this week, teachers' unions of the state's biggest systems, Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, Kenosha, and Racine, sent a letter to Governor Evers asking him to mandate an online-only start. For now, it looks like most students will experience at least some degree of virtual learning. The process got mixed reviews last spring, and experts say there are ways to make it better. Aaron Richards is a national education reporter for USA Today based in Milwaukee. Aaron, good to have you back.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, you've been looking at how schools around the nation are rolling out the new school year. What is the big trend lately?
Well, the big trend is nobody knows what plans are going to exactly entail in the fall. Even for districts that have decided to start the year online, there's still a lot of questions about what that's going to look like. For districts that are trying a hybrid model with some in-person learning and some at-home learning, nobody's tried that model before in any kind of widespread manner. So districts are still scrambling, and in many ways, many are still working out agreements with their teachers' union about what the rules around working will be. We're all facing a fundamentally different kind of school year. In many places, the start dates have even moved around from week to week. So it's just left a huge amount of uncertainty, not only for parents, but also for school staff and school employees.
All right. For schools that have already made the call to go all virtual, you know, last time around, it was, you know, we've got a week or two to do this, turn it out around, do the best we can. Do you see more intentional planning for how virtual schooling would work in a big district this time around?
Not a whole lot yet, and here's why. School districts are understandably overwhelmed with the amount of decisions that need to go into reopening their buildings, especially for districts that are trying to plan in-person instruction as well. There's a lot of questions around health and safety, a lot of questions around how much keeping people safe will cost, how to rearrange classrooms, how to retrofit buildings, how to use spaces that haven't been used before for instruction. And so that's left districts and individual schools, private and charter alike, with precious little time to examine, okay, what worked with virtual learning in the spring? What didn't work? How many kids and families still don't have devices or internet? How do we get them those devices and internet, especially in a place where we don't have as many resources as we've had before? And then on top of that, how do we train teachers better to teach in this online world We already know from spring that this was a really uneven experience for kids around the country. And so you're seeing some districts try to put some thought toward this, but honestly, even the state guidance on reopening plans across the country have prioritized health and safety over what the actual instructional methods will be.
Talking to Aaron Richards, national education reporter for USA Today, based in Milwaukee, looking at school reopenings, virtual, in-person combo, still undecided. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your opinion on what you want to see your school do, your concerns. Call in at 800-642-1234. Aaron, you wrote a piece that's advice to parents on what to look for to make sure kids get the best virtual education. It includes a lot of information that would probably be useful for schools, too. One thing that struck me was some schools had success using kind of lower tech models, not just, you know, hey, everything's over the internet. What kind of options did you see have some success?
So I know that in a time where a lot of us have access to the internet, that it seems old-fashioned to use paper packets. But there were some districts that had a really thoughtful approach to that. They gathered the materials. They tried to accommodate kids that didn't have the internet. In some cases, you had teachers that were collaborating virtually and putting together strong packets of material for kids that they could do at home, that they could work through at their own pace. And in most cases, when that's done well, the teacher is calling the kid, talking to the parent, talking to the child, trying to establish some kind of individual connection that makes that child still feel connected to school. There's some examples of this kind of remote learning in sort of other countries, parts of Canada and Australia, where kids live in really remote areas. There are successful ways to deliver paper packets remotely, but it takes a lot of time and planning up front, especially because a teacher isn't going to be coming out to your house every day. So there has to be some thought into organizing a packet that kids can do throughout the week. And so those were some of the methods that we saw. And if schools can't reach kids this fall, a lot of the experts I've talked to have said that they hope that schools will be even more intentional about getting those materials to kids in the fall if they don't have the digital resources.
And you touched on another common theme that you saw from schools and experts on this. So whatever the format is for remote learning, that individual contact between teachers and kids, parents and teachers, and so on, can really make a difference. Can you talk about that?
I talked to some teachers who have taught online before, often in virtual programs, and who now train teachers to be online instructors. And they said that individual communication with a student is really important in an online world. And here's why. It's easy to get lost in the crowd when you're a block on a screen in a virtual setting. And so these folks were saying, there must be robust grading feedback. You can't just put a number or a grade on a kid's paper anymore. You need to be able to establish, their name, what they did well, a description of how they can improve. And that means a lot more time for teachers to grade as well. That's a lot of follow-up. But without that in-person instruction, that this individual communication, whether it's written or verbal, needs to be much more intentional than what a student may otherwise get in a face-to-face classroom.
Now, one problem you found a lot of schools run into that maybe parents in particular found frustrating, and kids too, for that matter, not everybody within a school, like not all the teachers, might be using the same online platform for kids. So not only are you trying to learn the topic, you're trying to learn two or maybe three different web educational applications. What are we seeing out there?
Well, there's a couple of different things at work. Most districts, if they're offering an online program, need to have some kind of learning management system where all of that stuff is housed. That may be Google Classroom. It might be another product called Schoology. And then on top of that, teachers may use individual programs that are sort of housed within that. It might be Zoom. It might be Google Meet. It might be Teams meeting, whatever their district has chosen. But there should be one central place where parents can go to get all the information about, all their kids. There should be one single logon. It should be very easy to access the portal by which the educational materials sit. And parents and kids shouldn't have to go to six different places looking for that. So that's a really good question that parents can ask, and also kind of pressure their districts about. If there isn't one single place to go, then ask why, can this be streamlined? That it needs to be an easier process both for parents and for kids to log on.
We're talking about school reopenings during the coronavirus pandemic with Erin Richards. She's the national education reporter with USA Today and is based in Milwaukee. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you know what your school, whether your means you're the student, the parent, the teacher, the staffer, do you know what your school is doing in the fall? Is it all virtual, in person, some combo? What concerns do you have if it's virtual about how it's going to work, how to make sure the students get the most out of the experience? What safety concerns do you have if it's in person? What questions do you have for our guest about how schools are tackling some of these issues? And if you work with or are a student with an individualized educational plan, love to hear from you about how that went during virtual education last year, what you're working toward this year. 800-642-1234 is the number, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the upcoming school year amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Erin Richards is with us, Milwaukee-based national education reporter for USA Today, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is happening in the schools in your neck of the woods? What questions do you have about how schools are trying to deal with online education or safety for in-person education or managing and juggling both at the same time? What are your hopes and fears if you are a student, a teacher, a parent, an administrator in the school district? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Cora is with us in Madison. Cora, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me on. One of the things I wanted to highlight are some of the positives that we are learning through not being in face-to-face school. I think this is an opportunity to make some big changes that we have needed for a long time in education. Some of the things that I am already hearing from students and parents and educators that are positive is that some kids learn better in that environment. There are some children who do not want to be in the large group environment of a school setting. Some parents who like their children at home, at least all or part of the day. Parents and children who have liked the flexibility of online learning, maybe making more choices about what they want to really be participating in. And children that, like I said, may have fears about coming to school. There are several positives, and I think that most of the time what we're hearing is all the focus is on the difficulties. One thing I wanted to support that your visitor online was talking about was I do think it's great when schools are well organized and they have one central location where parents can go for distance learning to get every kind of resource and piece of information they need, even if it directs them to another location.
Cora, gotcha. I want to jump in. You gave us a lot there. Cora saying virtual can have benefits for students, and there already was some virtual education out there pre-COVID. Erin, do you think we'll see a move toward that more so even after soon, hopefully, we're out of the woods here?
I think you are. Where most of virtual education was happening before this was in virtual charter schools, which make up a very small part of the charter school population, but their numbers have grown and they've certainly had a lot more inquiries in the time of COVID. And to Cora's point, there have been kids who have been able to sort of easily or maybe more easily zoom through some of their studies, work independently, not be as distracted by some of the school-based issues that may have, maybe slowed their learning before. I would say that the reason why you're hearing more about some of the detrimental aspects of it is that, especially for working parents with younger kids, this has been exceptionally hard to manage. And for many of our vulnerable populations, people who are lower income, people who may not speak English as a first language, we're not hearing as much from them because they're not connected. In some large districts, up to half of the students weren't even logging on all the time. So there's a significant population here that is not getting much education at all. And that's why a lot of the stories you're reading are focusing on that issue as well.
Cora, thanks a lot for the call. Brad joins us now in DeForest. Brad, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Question I have, so I'm a parent and a teacher. Basically, for in-person learning, I've not seen anything from districts that are talking about in-person. As far as, like, what happens when a teacher has to go quarantine? What happens when a teacher is out sick? How are you going to maintain schools in-person learning when you're talking about having quarantine teachers or have extended sick time when teachers are out sick?
Brad, thanks for the call. Big issue, Erin.
Brad has asked the number one question of our times, which is, what do we do if a student or staff member tests positive in the building? This is something I asked one of the top infectious disease specialists at Harvard on a call the other day, and he said, it depends. If kids are kept in smaller groups and are learning with the same number of kids every day, there may not be a reason to send the entire school home on some kind of quarantine. Maybe you just move to remote learning for the small group that was working with that teacher or student. What's difficult here is that the CDC hasn't even issued guidance on this yet. They're supposed to have new recommendations coming, perhaps as soon as tonight or tomorrow. They said by the end of the month. We don't know if that's going to include the steps that a school should take if there's a single case, what steps they should take if there's a threshold of larger cases from a single school or across the district. And so I think everyone is looking to their local health experts on that. There's no set agreement yet that we've been able to see. And I've only seen one state plan from Massachusetts that recommended all of its schools have at least one room that's held as an isolation room for students or staff who test positive during the day.
Thanks for the call, Brad. But Brad's question also gets to, I guess, labor. You know, in addition to maybe people being sick during flu season, if you've got some teachers who have to quarantine, and I've heard concerns about, you know, the substitute teacher population. A lot of them are retired teachers who might be thinking, I'm in that at-risk age group. Do I really want to go to a school? Are we going to have a problem if we're trying to go full in-person, making sure we have teachers in the schools through all of this?
I mean, look, we already had a staffing problem in schools before the pandemic. There is absolutely going to be concerns about who is going to staff in-person learning groups or a full building. Some of the staffing agencies I talked to that staff substitutes for schools have already had a difficult time keeping up with the demand that districts are asking for. And in that case, I think you're also going to see more remote learning happening. Simply, you know, schools can't staff a building safely, then their only other option is to deliver some kind of education remotely.
Aaron, one question I want to make sure we get to is many students have what's called, I think, an individualized educational plan for whatever their learning needs might be. What happens to them in the virtual schooling in particular?
It's such a hard space, especially for kids with disabilities that are physical in nature, that need, you know, occupational therapy, that need, you know, physical assistance in schools. This has put a tremendous burden on families. It's some of the other disabilities can be addressed through virtual means, but there has to be modifications made to the legal plans that define what services those kids get in these times. And so districts are really going to have to double down and figure out how are we going to serve a diverse population of kids with special needs. And if those kids are at home, how are we going to dispatch resources to them in a way that can help them learn? In some cases, that's going to take a lot of parent partnership. And in some cases, I think districts are still looking for some additional guidance on how to do that.
One thing that strikes me, Aaron, in our last minute and a half or so is, you know, there are strong feelings on going back to school, not going back to school. There is no perfect answer. There's no flawless answer here, is there?
No, and one of the best quotes I saw lately was that it is dangerous for kids to be out of school. It may be dangerous for kids to be in school. It's, we've got a dangerous health crisis on our hands. Like, there is no perfect answer here. And to some degree, we're asking schools and superintendents and staff to take this leap into the unknown. We've all done the lockdown. We've done some degree of isolation. We haven't conducted school in a setting where there are cases rising this quickly. There hasn't been an example of that happening even around the world at the moment. Every other country that has kids in school has a much lower percentage positive case count than us. So this is really a difficult situation for schools, and they have to balance, you know, the safety of their staff and students foremost before they can talk about instruction.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Aaron Richards is a Milwaukee-based national education reporter with USA Today. We talked to her about school districts around the nation, how they're approaching the upcoming school year, and how parents can help ensure their kids get the most out of virtual learning. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll wrap up our series of candidate interviews in Wisconsin's 3rd District congressional primaries in central and western Wisconsin. Kenosha, on the other side of the state, was a long-running Democratic stronghold in elections until 2016. Our guest says Kenosha and cities and counties like it around the country could swing the presidential election this year. Plus on Food Friday, great summer beverages. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, it's a weekly call-in for kids and parents with dinosaurs and fossils this week, with special guests from the PBS show Prehistoric Road Trip. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk to a national advocate about why they're calling for the federal poverty guidelines to be updated, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.